Hello and welcome to New Books in Global Ethics and Politics. I'm one of your hosts of the channel, John McMahon, at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. On this episode, I speak with Carolyn Pedwell, senior lecturer at the University of Kent, about her book, Affective Relations, The Transnational Politics of Empathy, which came out from Palgrave Macmillan in 2014. In this book, Pedwell starts by observing that empathy is oftentimes a kind of political obsession, one that's generally viewed as a positive affective attribute to cultivate and that's used for social justice. However, she argues that in these assumptions about empathy, people don't ask what empathy does, what empathy is in multiple ways, and what the potential risks of empathy are. Thus, she argues that we need to ask how and with what implications empathy is differently felt, constructed, and mobilized. She asks these questions in a transnational context. Here she thinks through the ways that emotions are produced through transnational relations of power and how transnational politics work through the circulation of affect, thus attending to processes like empire, colonialism, slavery, diaspora, migration, development, globalization, global media, and much, much more. Pedwell argues that we must understand empathy as a social and political relation that involves the imbrication of cognitive, perceptual, and affective processes, but is also linked with conflict, power, oppression, inequalities, but also the potential for transformation. Pedwell thus takes the affective turn in humanities, social sciences, and critical theory, politicizes it, and thinks through its relation with empathy on a transnational scale, taking up this issue in a truly interdisciplinary work. Pedwell thinks through the ways that empathy might be translated in multiplicitous ways. Hope you enjoy our conversation, and as always, be sure to check out the full book. Joining me now is Carolyn Pedwell, who is Senior Lecturer in Cultural Studies and Cultural Sociology at the School of Social Policy, Sociology, and Social Research at the University of Kent. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Global Ethics and Politics.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. I'm really excited to have the chance to talk to you and to be part of it.
Yes, this book was an absolute joy to read, so I'm interested to talk to you as well. I was hoping, as is kind of the tradition on the New Books Network, if you could maybe start by telling us a bit about your background and how you came to write this particular book.
Yeah, one thing you might have noticed about the book, it's pretty interdisciplinary.
Yes.
And thinking about it, I think that's something that really has characterized all of my research and comes out of my background. So I did an undergraduate degree in politics and English and then went on to do graduate work in gender studies. And then the first job I got was in a media studies department. And now I'm working in cultural studies in a sociology department. So I think that that kind of background of working across different fields and disciplines and trying to find connections is something that's just actually quite fascinating to me in general and informs the way I look at a number of different problems that I've looked at in my research, and particularly for this book, thinking about how to make sense of what's been called the turn to affect.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I guess that's important to the book is to have an interdisciplinary approach to it, an approach, I guess, that's working across the humanities and the social sciences, but also looking at certain aspects of the hard sciences and trying to bring together what has been called the discursive and the material, and seeing what happens in experiments, I guess, to stage or to track or trace different kinds of conversations in that way.
Right. And I think it's a very successful set of experiments, because one of the most striking things from the book, for me at least, was the range of kinds of texts, theoretical orientations, disciplinary discourses, and so much more that you're working through. So as maybe we turn to talk about the book more specifically, could you talk some about why it was so important to kind of bring together and challenge so many kinds of intellectual boundaries to talk about empathy and to talk about affective relations transnationally?
Yeah. I guess maybe I should take a couple steps back and say,
sure,
why I was interested in empathy in the first place, and then why I thought kind of an interdisciplinary approach would be important. I guess I started this book probably in about 2008. And at that time I was really starting to notice, how prominent empathy seemed to be across a wide range of sites, you know, popular and more minor literatures, different kinds of fields and disciplines, and especially in the mainstream, but also in many critical literatures, empathy was widely assumed to be not only a good thing, but almost a kind of magical solution to a whole range, you know, of transnational social, political, cultural, and economic issues, problems, and grievances. There seemed to be this very seductive idea that empathy could function as a kind of affective balm or a means of creating social justice, whatever that might mean in these given contexts. So I guess the first thing I was interested in doing was thinking a bit more critically about empathy in that way of kind of following up some of the earlier feminist, anti-racist, and post-colonial work that had thought about empathy in that way and trying to think about that in a transnational context and in the contemporary context, you know, that we are working in today, which is neoliberal and arguably neocolonial and so forth. The second point that's linked to that was to think about, well, empathy is called for as this kind of solution or affective ingredient that would be important to creating social justice or to building affective bridges or links or lines of communications between different social, cultural, or national groups, imagined groups. But rarely have people really talked about what the transnational politics of empathy would entail. What does transnationality mean in this context? What would it mean critically to think about empathy and the turn to affect more broadly from a critical transnational perspective? So I think those two aims together necessitated an approach that was going to be able to follow empathy where it went in terms of different fields and disciplines, how it was conjured by different theoretical and political and social voices with different interests and different needs, that people that wanted empathy to do different kinds of works, and seeing how it was being materialized in those ways.
And it strikes me then that that kind of necessitates a somewhat different research and writing practice for working on a book like this that does track across so many different discourses and kinds of discourses. So what's kind of the process of working on this book like for you then?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I started with knowing that I wanted to say something about empathy and transnationality. And the hardest thing for me, I always kind of have a pretty good basic sense, at least, of the theoretical questions or kind of epistemological questions I want to ask. But it's thinking about what empirical or textual examples would really allow me to kind of flesh that out. I find that a lot harder. I don't usually start with the empirical, which I know is different from what a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But when I was thinking about that, it was 2008, I guess. And so this was when all the hype around Obama was going on. And I was, you know, really swept up in that, I guess I would say, and excited about it. And of course, you know, empathy and hope were key terms in Obama's campaign and kind of his modes of political communication and the way he talked about his governance. So there was something really interesting for me that gave me an empirical example to start working through. And that was the first chapter I wrote, where I was trying to think about, okay, you know, in Obama's political memoirs and speeches, this is somebody that is really speaking in a language that's very familiar to those of us who have been working in different parts of thinking about social justice and social theory. Yet at the same time, it also is very resonant with quite a different field around, you know, neoliberal economics and so forth. How do we kind of make those connections? So that was the first chapter that I wrote, and it was kind of a laboratory for trying to think about the question you were asking of how do you take an example and look at the different strands that make it up and what it means to bring into conversation feminist and anti-racist theorists and activists who are talking about empathy that kind of Obama resonates with in certain ways, and people who are writing in the business world that talk about empathy as being a really useful technique for corporations to use to get inside the heads of potential customers to really see what they would most need or desire or want in a product.
And so, go ahead.
So I think I just wrote that chapter and kind of saw what came out of it. And in a way, I used the same technique in the chapters that would follow.
Right. And feel free to mark kind of your own process as you were working through the chapters as you and I discussed them. But before we get to kind of some of the more details going on in the book, perhaps we could think a bit about what affective relations or the relationality of affect entails for you. So you could maybe discuss what that particular term does and what work it does for the project. And then maybe also a bit about how it relates to the many discourses of affect and emotion that are part of the affective turn.
Right. Okay. I guess relationality is a key term that's probably been central to the various research projects I worked on. And I guess it takes shape in a number of different ways in this project. The first one is to say, in order to think about how affect works, what emotion does, how to think about, you know, the social or the political in relation to affective processes, we need to be able to have ways of trying to think about how the emotional and the structural, the social, political are intertwined. How are they related? How do we understand those relationalities? And I mean, that was, you know, a way to have a starting point of saying emotions are not universal. They're not merely individual or personal, of course. They're produced in and through structural relations of power, but not in any kind of straightforward or deterministic way. So relationality was a way to try to grapple with complex relations between embodied processes, physiological reactions, emotional imagination, feelings between people, feelings between groups, and kind of formations of power, social, economic, political, cultural, and so forth. How do we kind of make those connections? Another way that relations or relationality is important in the book is to say that actually empathy as an emotion often is only produced, noticed, or makes sense in relation to its interactions with other emotions. One of the things that I noticed when I was doing this research is how often empathy is positioned as kind of singular and magical and, you know, as if it's kind of separated from feelings that tend to be positioned as negative or messy or kind of things we want to get rid of. So relations was about thinking about, well, how do we understand the relationship between empathy and shame? And might you need actually empathy and shame to happen concurrently in order for empathy to be meaningful in a particular way? Or what role might anger play in relation to empathy? So even though empathy is kind of a key word in the title of the book, I was interested in the relation between different emotions, affective states, relations of feelings. And I guess one of the key debates that has animated the turn to affect, I guess, in the last 10 years is a good question of, well, what is affect? What is emotion? How should we theorize these terms? A number of people, I guess, most notably Brian Massumi, have argued that they should be seen as distinctly different. They pertain to different orders, different systems. Affect is kind of not captured by discourse. It's free flowing, and in some definitions, it pertains more to autonomic or kind of non-conscious processes. And on the other hand, emotion is kind of what we call feelings once they become captured by discourse, once they become bounded in a certain way. And I think that those ways of thinking about the division between emotion and affect can be analytically useful. It can be helpful, but I actually am more interested in how affect and emotion and feeling and other terms kind of overlap, and how it's not possible to make any definite or finite separation between them. So that would perhaps be a third understanding of relationality that comes out in the book. What are the relationships historically and in the contemporary context between all these different terms that we have to talk about affect, emotion, feeling, sentiment, mood, and so forth?
Right. And I think that messiness is very generative as one reads through the book. So I certainly appreciated that in particular regards to kind of some of my own work in affect as well. And so one more kind of preliminary question before we really do get into the various chapters of the book is talk about what the transnational entails for you and why the transnationality is so necessary for thinking through affective relations and thinking through empathy, especially in terms of global power relations, colonialism and neocolonialism, et cetera.
So I guess one of the key ways I talked about transnationality in the book, drawing on, you know, important genealogies of feminist and post-colonial writing especially, was to think about how time and space get refigured when we think about not just nations or cultural groups as bounded entities, as separable, but to think about a kind of ontological transnational relationality where border crossing processes, where exchanges between places, people, groups have something that's been ongoing before we could find a, you know, an origin point, that this is something ontological. And then trying to think about that in more empirical terms, to think about, well, how do we make sense of our world today as a product of histories of slavery, forced migration, of processes of coloniality and post-coloniality and continuing decolonization, more contemporary processes of structural adjustment and international development, neoliberalism and biopolitics, and things like the production of global media and popular culture, international security paradigms. I could list other examples, but it's to think about how different overlapping and continuous processes constitute a world where it's never possible to talk about a nation or a culture or an ethnicity as if it's singular and bounded, that we're always talking about a kind of ontological movement, exchange, crisscrossing, imbrication of people and places and histories. So I guess then the question is, well, what does that mean for how we think about emotion? What does that mean for how we think about the ways that feelings, affects, emotions, and the way that we understand these categories and what they do translate across space and time? What frameworks can we have for understanding those diverse translations and what they mean for kind of the ways that feelings materialize politically?
Yes, and I think, and that's the other thing, is that I think it seems to me that this turn of the transnational is one of the most important modes of politicizing affects for you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think as soon as you are foregrounding the transnational and transnational politics, then you can't kind of rest on easy universalisms, set categories, static truths or kind of ways of thinking. Everything's in movement. And I think that's really important for politicizing empathy or affect more generally. That we're thinking about movement, we're thinking about relations between people, we're thinking about economic relations that are fluid, that are political. So what one outcome of that is that empathy can't just be posed as an abiding kind of solution or effective bomb, that it itself is multiple, it's fluid, it means different things in different contexts. It's materialized and felt potentially differently in different contexts. I think that movement and that translation and that kind of thinking about feeling itself being materialized differently and with different political implications as probably central to thinking about the relationship between emotion and transnational politics.
Right. And as we perhaps turn to the first chapter now, where you're one example of you complicating calls for empathy as a way to achieve social justice, where perhaps I could ask you to expand a bit and articulate what the imbrication of, say, Barack Obama's invocation of empathy in his political rhetoric and pop business discourses about the empathy economy and so on, how those work perhaps in similar ways.
Hmm. Yeah. So, in many ways, I found reading Obama's first two memoirs very engaging, very interesting, very, very seductive. I think the language he used, as I mentioned, resonates in some ways very strongly with a kind of feminist, anti-racist politics that I'm very familiar with. But what was interesting to me, too, when I was reading his memoirs and then later a wider range of kind of political speeches from his office and other forms of political communication, is how much they simultaneously chime with a very familiar kind of neoliberal rhetoric about personal responsibility, self-enterprising, having an obligation to be the best that one can be, both as an individual citizen and as a nation. So I was trying to think about, well, how do those two things work together? How can this be a set of discursive practices that sounds both very feminist and anti-racist and concerned with social justice, but at the same time, actually speaking in a very similar language to corporate and professional business literatures that are invoking empathy as an effective technique used to generate greater global economic competitiveness and profits. And it's not surprising, of course, that Obama's discourse is neoliberal in any way, but it is interesting kind of how these different things come together in his political communication and the role that empathy plays there. So in the business literatures, empathy is seen as kind of a universal instinct. It's something that everybody has or has the potential to kind of cultivate. And it's something that corporations specifically should cultivate because it's almost an effective mind-reading practice to look into the minds and hearts of potential consumers or customers and to think about what would they really want? What type of product would they want? What would they need? And to use empathy as a technique to think about, well, how can we improve our competitiveness? How can we create, greater profits? It's in this context, although the language of care, concern, compassion, and empathy are used, this is not, about social justice. It's about profit accumulation and creating economic value. And in many ways, those goals are, of course, central in Obama's discourse as well. So that was how I started trying to think about some of those connections.
Right. And one of the things that is happening throughout the book is you noting the ambivalence of empathy. And so kind of the way I read it, it almost works on two levels, whereas perhaps, as you've discussed already, kind of the intuition is that empathy can be something that's just simply good. You want to complicate that. But you also are very careful to say that there's no easy good or bad distinction between different kinds of empathy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's certainly an important point. So what I was trying to do in this chapter and in some of the other ones where I was talking about empathy in the context of neoliberalism is not to set up, as you suggest, a kind of good-bad divide where bad empathy works in the interests of neoliberalism and global capitalism and good empathy would somehow be outside of those paradigms. The point I try to make is that no such divide is possible today. As academics, as professionals, we're all working within a context that's constituted by a range of shifting and changing neoliberal discourses and practices of governance. So it's not that we can stand outside that or somehow purify emotional discourses or strategies or emotions themselves, perhaps, from this context. But we can think about their ambivalence. We can think about both the ambivalence of neoliberal practices themselves and the ambivalence, as you suggest, of emotion and affect. So I guess in the first chapter where I'm talking about empathy, Obama, neoliberalism, and business discourses, I'm looking at some of the cracks and crevices that emerge. So I was thinking about, okay, well, what happens when we move outside Obama's political memoirs and speeches themselves, and we think about Obama mania as a wider, you know, set of processes and discourses of empathy, hope, and you know, other ideas and effective relations. How can we think about the ambivalence of empathy and its relation to hope there? Is there more going on there? And I mean, one of the arguments I make is that empathy is not just reduced to an effective technique of profit accumulation or kind of an emotion that can be serviceable to the interests of neoliberalism, that people are using or engaging in relations of feeling in ways that themselves point at these ambivalences, you know, ways that point at how emotion or hope can function to include some and exclude others, that people are having these conversations, you know, on Twitter or other social media or, you know, in various political forums, that in this way, empathy functions as a space of political mediation in some interesting and critical ways.
Right. Now, keeping in mind with the interdisciplinary and kind of multiplicitous nature of this project, could you maybe walk us through a bit how work on both Black radical imaginations and queer futurity and hope helps you do that particular work in this chapter?
Yeah. So, yeah, certainly in terms of thinking about Black radical imagination, it was Robin E. Kelly's book, and Sarah Ahmed recommended that book to me, to think about the histories and genealogies of Black radical thought. One of Kelly's arguments is that both empathy and hope have been central to many forms of Black radical thought. Empathy as a way to kind of imagine and recreate past horrors, for example, associated with histories of slavery and segregation, and their obviously ongoing effects. But at the same time, to link that to hope and a kind of radical hope that things could be different than how they have been and how they are today, that there are alternatives, that to think radically, to think through radical hope joined to an empathy, gives you both an understanding of social realities and an ability to see how things could be otherwise. And so it was interesting to think about how, although Obama, for example, draws on, you know, neoliberal discourses and ways of governing, that particular seeds of kind of that effective politics of Black radical imagination can be seen in his writing and in the ways that the kind of affects associated with him as a figure have circulated more widely through Obama mania. And, you know, I think there's connections then to be found in some of the critical feminist and queer literatures, you know, thinking about queer practices of thinking about futurity. I was using Jose Munoz's fantastic book to think about also, you know, radical hope in another way. And thinking about temporality, I guess joining empathy and hope means thinking about time in certain ways. It means thinking about time is not unfolding in a kind of linear or set way. It's thinking about different kind of temporalities happening at the same time on top of each other, that if we look back to the past, we can think about things that have happened, but we can also think about how things could be otherwise, how they could be otherwise in the past, how they could be otherwise now. I mean, I think I'm getting a bit out of hand in talking about this, but I guess that that those literatures and the kind of anti-racist, feminist, and queer texts about you know, social justice and emotions give us tools to think about time and space in relation to the politics of emotion in productive and interesting ways.
Right. And I certainly would like to return to this question of temporality and space in some of the later chapters where you're working with post-colonial literary works. And then in the second chapter, I want to kind of pick up here on what you're doing more so with anti-racist and feminist theory more specifically. And so chapter two is working with bringing together anti-racist and feminist theories of empathy and social justice. It's bringing in work on affect and visual culture and media and the international development literature. And here mm-hmm. you're kind of engaging in a sort of critical examination of discourses about self-transformational empathy and the distant other in the context of colonialism and neoliberalism. So here, why and how do these texts of international development immersion programs help us think through these connections between empathy, post-coloniality, and neoliberalism?
Mm-hmm. I think international development as a kind of set of practices and discourses works well to bring together empathy, neoliberalism, and post-coloniality for a number of reasons. I mean, we can think about international development as something that comes together in certain ways in the post-colonial era as a product of kind of structural adjustments. So those post-colonial legacies are very much part of how international paradigms have been formed and kind of what they have to grapple with. And certainly, you know, in more recent decades, kind of neoliberal imperatives for how international development should work have, you know, been central to the way that various international and national organizations have been organizing and talking about development. And probably the most recent development, or at least talked about most recently, is the role of emotion and affect in international development. That, you know, emotion and how people feel both development workers and officials and those that their work is meant to be for, what types of feelings, relations of feeling, emotional development, aspirations and hope and so forth, what's going on there is seen as not peripheral or tangential to international development work, but potentially central to certain projects that are carried out. So I was interested in how those types of issues are being talked about and playing out in programs called immersions. And immersions are where international development workers or officials or government officials associated with those agencies, usually based in the global north or west, but sometimes in the capital cities of countries in the global south or other locations, are sent for 4 or 5 days or you know, maybe a week to live with a so-called poor family in a so-called developing context. And these are people who may, you know, the international development workers or government officials who may have had no other reason to be in that context. And what I was interested in is how much of a central role discussion of emotions and empathy in particular plays in the ways that these immersion programs are talked about. How they were seen as good practice, what the outcomes of them are understood to be, that empathy is seen as the generation of empathy, of kind of being on the ground in this particular location, of seeing the, you know, potential hardships and struggles that poor families are going through to negotiate a life in poverty, that actually facing that reality face-to-face, you know, in a kind of embodied, visceral way, that this is what's necessary to create empathy on the part of senior development people or government workers, and that this empathy will be important and necessary to creating socially just or productive pro-poor is a word that's used in the discourses policies. So, you know, there's a lot of questions to be asked about that. What does it mean to kind of really put an emphasis on the emotional truth that can be gleaned by being empirically face-to-face somewhere? You know, I think one of the arguments I tried to make in that chapter is that if before we kind of had this objectivist idea that in order to be rational and objective or whatever, I'm thinking, you know, into genealogy's way back of thinking about how knowledge should be produced, that emotion and affect should be kind of subtracted or cleansed out of that process, that in this example and several other sites, we're kind of seeing the aftermath of that, that emotions and affect now are figured as being, you know, straightforward messengers of truth, of objective reality.
And then in what ways, as you argue in the book, does this often end up reproducing inequalities between different kinds of subject? Affective inequalities, inequalities of geopolitical power relations, and so on.
Yeah. So, and then that's the important question. So, I mean, the first point would be to say that in the ways that these programs were talked about in, you know, the international development journals that were discussing them, you know, it's notable that we're talking about these affective journeys of self-transformation, these journeys of coming to empathy through being part of the emergence programs. It's always the development workers and the government officials. It's always the twists and turns of their affective journeys that are being described, that are kind of being pulled apart, that are being grappled with. And this might be important in a number of ways. The problem, though, is that the kind of so-called poor family, the hosts in so-called developing contexts, their emotional journeys are actually given very little attention. So we have empathy, we have kind of the development officials and other workers having the chance to kind of develop empathy as an affective skill, to develop their range of kind of affective and ethical skills and capacities, where the kind of recipients of development work are once again fixed in place and really seem to have quite a flat affective life. And so there's the question of, well, at an effective level, the level of effective politics, what's happening there? Are relations of power actually being disrupted, or are they being reified in certain ways? And I think maybe a second point is, when emotion or affect produced through a face-to-face encounter is understood as a route to seeing a truth, you know, of kind of really being struck by a reality of a situation, how do we take into account, you know, all of the histories, the discursive, you know, social post-colonial histories, which construct how people see, you know, that create locations for people to approach the world. Through this discourse of emotion as truth, all of these kind of, you know, layers of history and power and politics that construct interactions as they happen are kind of taken out of the picture. And so we're reduced in some ways, I think, to this idea that a one-on-one encounter that is unmediated by histories of power, the idea that that could happen if it's at an emotional level.
Right. And chapter three, then, I think, takes up very interestingly and very productively this kind of dual question of how does one confront these forms of empathy that might reify particular forms of inequality on the one hand, and on the other hand, how does one introduce alternative and different temporalities into discourses and assumptions and practices related to empathy. And here in chapter three, you do so through a reading of Jamaica Kincaid's work, A Small Place. So to get into some of these questions, maybe you can start by talking about how Kincaid's work and how your work with Kincaid trace other affects that work around or potentially with empathy, for example, shame, anger, melancholia, and so on.
Mm-hmm. I first read Kincaid's A Small Place when I was an undergraduate in Canada, taking Canadian and postcolonial fiction, I think, as one of my courses. And so I remembered it, but I didn't encounter it again until a few years back when I was teaching at Newcastle University. And one of my friends was teaching a course on postcolonial literature, and this was one of the texts she assigned. And she said that every time she assigned it, her students, some of them would get really angry about it, that there was quite a hostile reaction to this text. And kind of, it was always a bit of a problem of, in the classroom, what do you do with this affect and where is it coming from? So that kind of reminded me of this book and made me want to think about kind of the effect of politics in the writing of it and its reception. As I think lots of people probably know this text, it's told from the perspective by Kincaid or Kincaid's narrator of a white European or North American tourist arriving in Antigua in an airplane into the airport, and all of the kind of, you know, beautiful scenery that they'll see when they come in, imagining this, you know, fabulous holiday that they've saved up to go on for 10 days to escape, you know, the hustle and bustle and stress of life in a big city. And then, you know, right away in the first, you know, page of the book, Kincaid's narrator says, of course, since you're thinking about all these great things and you know, looking for turquoise water and beautiful palm trees, you won't stop to think, you know, about how people survive when, you know, actually clean, fresh water is very hard to come by. And, you know, you won't stop to think when you're swimming in this beautiful water of all of the, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of slaves that have drowned in these waters. So, you know, right away, kind of the reader, whoever they are, is given a sense that this will not just be kind of a pleasurable literary tour kind of the island of Antigua imagined by Kincaid's narrator. This will be an effective experience for the reader where they are being asked to kind of be held to account as this imagined tourist is for kind of where they might be figured in this tourist economy in Antigua in the late 1980s that Kincaid's laying out, and how to think about how this, you know, tourist economy of the 1980s is inseparably linked to histories of slavery and colonialism and in the Caribbean and elsewhere. So I was interested in this book, thinking about, you know, my colleague's anecdote about how her mainly white middle-class students were getting very angry about it, because I suppose that some of them felt that they were being interpolated as this white middle-class North American or European tourist that Kincaid talks about, and they didn't want to see themselves in this position, this very kind of stereotyped, you know, position, and I wanted to think about what that meant. And I was also interested in the fact that, you know, I think maybe some of these students and other commentators of the book have seen Kincaid's mode of address as very hostile, very uncompromising, very angry. But to me, what was interesting is that her style, her way of talking, could actually be understood as empathetic. It's a mode of empathy because she, as narrator, inhabits the mental world, the kind of journey that this imagined tourist would take from getting on the plane and landing in Antigua and negotiating, you know, the island as a tourist. That this is, this mode of imaginative reconstruction is a mode of empathy. So what then does it mean to think about empathy as not necessarily being about care, you know, concern for the other, about sympathetic relations or compassion? What does it mean to think about empathy as being potentially angry, uncompromising, determined to hold people to account for relations of violence and power? How does that help us try to think about empathy in different ways to how it's been positioned as kind of affective solution or balm to, you know, all sorts of problems in the mainstream discourses?
Right. And then part of that, at least in Kincaid's work, is to confront, and you use the term confrontational empathy here in this chapter and elsewhere, to confront the reader with different kinds of temporalities besides the temporality of them on vacation or the temporality of their lives wherever their home country is from. So what's the relationship between empathy and temporality, or empathies and temporalities in the plural?
Mm-hmm. I guess the first thing to say that I think in the mainstream, empathy has an implicit temporality, a linear temporality, like when it's invoked as something positive, as something that we need. There's an idea that empathy will have a linear trajectory where once we generate enough of it, we'll reach a point of, you know, nonviolence or reduced antagonisms or, you know, better relations of feeling among people and, you know, social justice, whatever it might mean in a given context, will be created. That this idea that time will move in a linear fashion and progressively. So, you know, I guess one of the things about thinking about the relationship between empathy and temporality is to try to scramble that a little bit, to try to think about, well, what does it mean, or how does thinking about emotion and affect enable us to think about how there are multiple temporalities going on at the same time, how people live in and through different relationships with time, different temporalities in given context. Why would the past, in the case of Kincaid's novel, histories of slavery, colonialism, structural adjustment, seem much more recent or much more in the present for some people in circumstances, certain circumstances, than they would for others? Why does slavery seem like something that's hundreds of years in the past, done and over, for certain white middle-class American or European tourists that Kincaid imagines? Or what? Why might it? And why then might, for people that she also imagines who are living on the island, but it might it seem very much here today in different forms? And, you know, I think for Kincaid, empathy is, you know, the empathetic technique she uses as a narrator enables her to show, to highlight, to kind of activate those temporalities. But she's also calling on the reader in a certain sense to generate a particular kind of empathy that can understand that can understand, you know, that temporalities and spatialities are produced through politics, that people live in relation to time and space differently because of how, you know, structures of power are organized.
Right. And thus, as you discuss the importance of something like shame or anger in generating alternative kinds of empathies.
Yeah, I think in the mainstream, it's kind of also like empathy is understood as what can overpower bad feelings, what could get rid of shame or anger or other feelings that are usually thought of as things that are detrimental or that, you know, we need to overcome. So one of the things that I think Kincaid does, and that I was interested in this chapter, is what would it mean to think about anger and shame as potentially important, inevitable, you know, useful and productive, and, you know, always kind of bound in certain ways to empathy. So I think that Kincaid, you know, in the first place, rather than trying to kind of garner empathy from this imagined tourist and the reader that she's imagining may, in some ways, some readers may fit the position of the stereotypical tourist. And instead of trying to enlist a kind of universal empathy for the situation and plight of you know, certain of people living in Antigua, in the first instance, it seems that the Kincaid tries to create shame on the part of this imagined tourist for their complicity in these histories of slavery and colonialism and structural adjustment and the ongoing effects of these histories in this context. But at the same time, you know, I don't think that Kincaid is arguing, and I don't want to argue that shame is necessarily, you know, more important or more effective than empathy, but that feeling shame might enable empathy to move beyond a kind of narcissistic relation to the self, of wanting to see the self in a certain way, that you might need both empathy and shame happening together to actually see some sort of effective relation that could, you know, do more than either emotion does alone.
Right. Now, in chapter four, you turn to a different post-colonial literary work, Aminata Forna's Memory of Love. So mm-hmm. how does her work help us move toward empathy as what you call affective translation, and away from empathy as something like knowledge or equivalence or truth?
Yeah. So Aminata Forna's novel, The Memory of Love, is set in Sierra Leone across two different timescapes, but much of the story is told after the end of the 11-year civil war in that country, and it's happening kind of at the beginning of the decade of the 2000s, 2000, in the early years of after the year 2000. And quite a bit of the story is told from the perspective of Adrian, who's a clinical psychologist working in London in the UK, who goes to Sierra Leone with the hope or the desire to kind of help people who have been the victims and in some cases perpetrators of this violence, to kind of help people heal, to play a role in really helping the nation heal. And he's also looking, you know, for something in his own life, for some sort of affective transformation that will give his life meaning. And so Adrian goes to Freetown in Sierra Leone, equipped with a certain kind of empathy. And it's an empathy that seeks knowledge about this very, to him, culturally different place, that the kind of empathy that he understands, that he wants to build, that he thinks will make him able to help people there, is one that seeks to gain accurate, precise cultural understanding about the place, about its history, about its people. He seeks a kind of empathy that works through cultural mastery. If he could just really understand everything, if he could understand what has happened, how people are, the kind of different languages, emotional norms, ways of interacting, then he would really be able to do something. And I think in my reading, through the course of Forna's novel, this type of empathy that you know, empathy is cultural mastery of seeking accurate knowledge, is shown to be often ineffective for Adrian and problematic. That it's a kind of empathy that really seeks mastery without opening oneself out to being vulnerable, without opening oneself out to actually being affected by what is perceived as being foreign. And so it's only when this character Adrian is able, for different reasons, one of them being that he at one point becomes ill with malaria, is able to kind of engage in a different type of empathy, a different type of affective practice, which is one about, to a certain extent, becoming vulnerable, but thinking about what would it mean to really be affected by what is experienced as different. As difference, to be affected by, or to not expect that you can fully know something that is different to you, to not expect that you could master that difference, but instead to be open to being affected by it, to be being affected by the way that temporality and time seems different, to being affected by the different emotional norms and practices that he's that he encounters, but I think also to being politically challenged. The character is politically challenged to really interrogate his habitual ways of thinking and feeling, to interrogate how his very ways of feeling, his emotions, are interlinked with power, with histories of power that make him see and feel in certain ways.
Right. And there's a different kind of affective translation at work in the fifth chapter of the book. which takes the form of a critical rereading, or we might say appropriation of The Age of Empathy by Franz de Waal. Could you maybe give us a little bit of background on that work, walking us through perhaps both the with kind of political assumptions or presumptions that are attached to it, and then how you reinterpret and disrupt those political assumptions to mobilize the work in a different way?
Yeah, so this last chapter was moving to, I guess, quite a different realm than some of the other ones, because it was trying to think about how empathy is conjured in some of the both kind of more academic scientific research on empathy, both in neuroscience and other fields, and to think about the popular science of empathy. And so I picked Franz de Waal's book, The Age of Empathy, because it's been a bestseller. It's circulated widely. De Waal is an ethologist. So the research is about primate behavior and what we can understand about relations between primates and what's fundamental. The book is sold as being a powerful counterargument to the, you know, long-held assumption that both, you know, primates and by an extension humans are fundamentally violent, aggressive, competitive, and so forth. The book is sold as telling a much warmer, fuzzier story about primates and humans being fundamentally empathetic. And, you know, there's an interesting link or translation made between the scientific research that's reported, that's talked about, and what that might mean for how we can understand society and how it can work. And so one of the you know, taglines of the book is greed is out, empathy is in. And the argument that de Waal makes kind of in the popular science discourse is that, you know, once we understand that primates and humans are essentially empathetic, that this will allow us to pave the way for different ways of organizing society, that actually it naturally makes sense for society to be organized along lines of reciprocity, cooperation, and social justice, not in terms of profit accumulation, greed, you know, and violence. But I was interested in looking beneath kind of that way that the book is sold to actually think about what types of arguments are being made for the science of empathy and actually how it's a much more ambivalent and complex story than de Waal is telling. And I kind of return here to some of the techniques used in the first chapter to think about contextualizing popular science and de Waal's book in particular in the context of contemporary neoliberal discourses and forms of governance. And the argument I make is that actually, you know, de Waal's empathy isn't necessarily about cooperation or reciprocity per se. It's about self-interest. There's a quite strong kind of centrist neoliberal agenda being articulated politically in the book, and therefore kind of some of the scientific data, the research on primates is being inflected with that political aim. And this is in a context where, you know, de Waal and other scientists have said that, well, you know, science is the only true discourse that can talk about the nature of humans and how they are, because it is, you know, free from ideology and from politics and so forth. And, you know, I was wanting to show that, well, no, it's very much produced through the political, that the very way that the science here is being materialized is working in certain political ways, and specifically to argue for some centrist neoliberal ideologies. So I guess the interest I had in how science, the science of empathy or sciences of empathy, might then be translated differently. If there's no kind of originary science that's free of power or politics, at what different points might we translate differently? Might we understand some of this research about mirror neurons in this context and empathy as working potentially to support other types of political goals and aims, how might we think about empathy, not in terms of neoliberal responsabilization, but rather about transnational solidarity? So I was trying to, I guess, read some of the Duval's book and other kind of neuroscience scientific work about empathy against the grain through cultural, political, and social theory to think about how it might be reinterpreted differently to support a kind of vision of affective solidarity rather than a neoliberal politics.
Right. And perhaps that gives us a good note to close on, as I've taken up much of your time already, but maybe you could kind of offer some summary comments, kind of in the spirit of interdisciplinarity of this project, how you're kind of reassembling some of these chapters and different works and discourses together in the conclusion to think about the transformative potential of empathy in its relationality, in its transnationality, in its ambivalence, in what you call its afterlives, and so on.
I guess what I've tried to do in the book as a whole is to, you know, be critical of the ways that empathy is called for as effective solution, as kind of effective route to social justice, without dismissing empathy, without dismissing kind of the desire that so many of us seem to have for it, the kind of affective potential that seems to kind of be there. And so I guess what I end on is thinking about, you know, that actually this interdisciplinary, ambivalent, multiple approach to empathy in its relationship to other emotions and relations of feeling might, you know, not dissolve into something that's so diffuse and multiple that it turns into nothing, but might give us techniques to really think about the affective nature of contemporary politics, to think about the diverse and complex ways that emotions and affects are linked to political relations of power, and to think about the ways that new solidarities might be formed. So I think I end the book by saying that, you know, if anything should be clear by the end of it, it's that there's no straightforward, linear or unproblematic relationship between empathy and social justice. You know, the generation of empathy can kind of divide, can exclude, you know, can participate in modes of violence as much as it can bring together and generate more positive relations of feeling. But perhaps, you know, in the midst of all of that, what remains is the kind of desire for contact, lines of communication, reciprocity and relationality that this attachment to empathy seems to signal. And so I think the question I asked to end the book is kind of like, if empathy points to a fundamental transnational relationality that binds us all in complex ways, where we are affected by and affecting each other, humans and non-humans, in all sorts of different ways, then what types of affective relations do we want to create and pursue and sustain?
Thank you. Now, before we part, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to discuss and let the listeners know about?
I actually think you covered everything. I can't think of anything further to add.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Then I would like to ask you if you could maybe end by telling us a bit about what you're working on currently.
Yeah, my current research in its very early stages is about the concept of habit. And this comes out of the book Affective Relations in different ways. I think especially towards the end of the book, that last chapter we talked about in terms of the science of empathy, I started thinking and reading a lot more about the less conscious, less willed aspects of empathy and affective relations more generally, and their potential political significance. Thinking about affective habits, affective interactions, affective norms that are not necessarily about conscious practices of imagination or kind of willed conduct, but very much, you know, below the level of conscious subjectivity. And so I'm trying to pursue the concept of habit as one route to research that, to grapple with those issues further.
That's very exciting, and I look forward to seeing what comes of that. Carolyn Pedwell, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much, John.